The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by Damon Linker, who is Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania, and he also is the author of a brilliant Substack, which is called Notes from the Middle Ground, and you can get that at damonlinker.substack.com. Damon, lots of things I want to talk to you about, really, but I thought I'd start by saying it's now, I think, 11 days since Joe Biden gave his State of the Union address. And a lot of Democrats were quite fired up by it. Certainly Biden seemed pretty fired up. It seemed to reassure a lot of doubters as to whether he was capable of giving a speech at all. And you would normally expect after such a response to a speech to see a little uptick in the polls for Biden at least. And it seems that just hasn't happened. Why is that? Why has there been no noticeable impact in the polls?
Well, I think what you just described about the reaction to the State of the Union is accurate, but I think the reason why that might lead someone to think it would produce a bounce in the polls for Biden is that it's a conversation among Democrats, you know, kind of trying to psych themselves up about the upcoming election, make themselves feel better, placate anxiety and things like that. And the problem is that most Democrats still support Biden. We'll probably talk in a little bit about the fact that that is not all Democrats, but something around 80% say they're happy with Biden. So the fact that 80% of Democrats were all really jazzed up by this speech doesn't really tell you how he's going to do in the polls, because what to do better in the polls, he has to actually convince swing voters, moderates, independents, and maybe wavering Republicans who aren't happy about the prospect of having to vote for Donald Trump again. He has to convince them that he is someone they should get excited about. And I don't think there was a lot in that speech for such voters. That's at least how the speech looked to me listening to it. So I'm not especially surprised. Now, it's also true that State of the Unions sometimes don't produce any improvement for the president. And if they do, it usually washes out within a few weeks. So it's usually not a big thing. But it's also true that this speech was highly political. It was very much a campaign speech in style and tone and content, much more than a standard State of the Union. So if any State of the Union was going to really help the president, this is one you might think would. But it appears not to have done anything. Biden remains in the low, around like 38%, between 38-39%, occasionally rises to almost 40, and then tracks back down to 38. He sort of bounces around in that range, and he remains there today.
Well, the State of the Union focused, as a lot of Biden's speeches do, particularly when he's in campaign mode, on Trump, or my predecessor, as he sometimes refuses to call him Trump and calls him my predecessor. And that certainly seems to be Team Biden's strategy, is to focus minds as much as possible on the MAGA extremism, as he's also called it, on Trump, and to try and rev up anti-Trump sentiment, of which there is a considerable amount in the country. But so far, that does not, again, we're only in March and lots could change, but so far that doesn't seem to be working for the Democrats. I mean, the more people are focusing on the election, the more they seem to be moving ever so slightly towards Trump.
Yeah, it's a really interesting. And if you're like me and really dread the prospect of Trump winning again, it's a pretty alarming spectacle that we are seeing over here on this side of the ocean. Because at least for someone like myself, who's been observing this up close for 8 years now, Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016, especially in the fall campaign in the last couple of months before the election, really pushed this same line. You know, quotes from Trump, videos of Trump saying outrageous things, making the case essentially like, oh, come on, America, there's no way we're going to vote for this guy, right? With the underlying message that, of course, he couldn't possibly win. This guy's a lunatic and so forth. And of course, Trump did win. Now, the Biden campaign in 2020 tried something very similar. And that time, of course, it worked. There was also the fact that we were in this kind of crazy, unprecedented context of the COVID pandemic. And so the year 2020 was an especially crazy year. People were, for much of it, in lockdown, very grumpy, depressed, angry, on social media and on computers more than even normal. And then you had all of the kind of post-George Floyd protests and sometimes riots and looting out there, which made things seem even more chaotic than before. Trump gets COVID in the middle of the fall campaign. It was total chaos. And so in that context, a message of, come on, America, we can't do this anymore. We need to go to something else. It got some traction. The question is, in 2024, after Americans all lived through Trump for 4 years and now have lived through Biden for three, and they're doing a kind of comparison shopping thing here. It's the first time since the late 19th century that Americans are being confronted by an incumbent sitting president and a former president who they have 4 years of experience with. They've got side-by-side comparison here. And if the polls are showing that slightly more people prefer Trump, that says to me that repeating over and over and over again how terrible Trump is not likely to get much traction, because we all lived through it. We remember what it was like. And my fear is that a lot of people are listening to this and are in effect saying, yeah, I don't like Trump. The crazy tweets were nuts. The things he says and does were often really unpleasant, not ideal, but when I look at the economy, the state of the world, in general, things seemed better, at least up until COVID happened. So Trump through till like, you know, late February, early March 2020 was better than a comparable period over the last 3 years. And if that's the case, then Biden can repeat the, oh my gosh, MAGA extremism line over and over again, and it's not going to get much traction. And, you know, the fact that Biden's doing as well as he is testament to, yeah, as you said, there are tens of millions of Americans who cannot stand the guy and would basically, as I've sometimes said in my writing, would vote for a potted plant over Trump if that was the choice. But, you know, it's not a potted plant. It's Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has a record. And the question is, how many people at this point are persuadable?
Yes.
Given that, again, we're dealing with an election with a side-by-side comparison, which you almost never get. Usually it's a sitting president who, whatever his faults are, you figure, well, here's the record. I've been living under this for the last three or so years, versus some untested person who has never been president, who we're just sizing up for the very first time at a national scale. But this time we have basically, you've got 2017 to 2020 versus 2021 to 2024. And you're asking yourself, which one do you prefer? And an alarmingly large number of Americans appear to be saying, things were better 4 years ago.
Well, I like your potted plant campaign. I think that could get quite a lot of traction. Potted plant 2024.
Well, the potted plant would have lower negatives than either of these guys.
It's the no-labels potted plant candidate.
Yes, exactly.
Well, one term we hear quite a lot, which perhaps you could help us understand a bit, is the double haters. In 2016, the haters sort of went away from Obama-era Democratic Party to Obama, Clinton, etc., towards Trump. It's thought that those people, and these are the sort of key independents who could swing the election, they went back to Biden in 2020. And it's thought that in 2024, the number of double haters is much, much bigger. Some people think up to 20%, I think. And that is a significant factor. And it seems to be that those double haters are now going back towards Trump rather than towards Biden or possibly even an RFK Jr., a third party.
Yeah, it's true. We are trapped in a kind of dynamic here where negativity is pervasive in the political system, so that people are only rarely voting for someone because they actually prefer that person over the other in a positive sense. It's much more, which of these two people whom I hate do I hate a little less than the other? And then they go for that person. And the thing that really is striking, and I don't think gets enough attention, is, you know, we don't have enough data to know how big of a trend it is. Because as recently as Barack Obama, Obama was kind of went up and down, kind of sometimes above water in the polls, sometimes below. But in general, yeah, he won re-election with a fair amount of positive support. But with Trump, what you saw was he came in, had a honeymoon of like 2 weeks, and then was already underwater, meaning more people disapproved than approved of him. And he remained underwater by a long, you know, very far underwater for his entire presidency. Then Biden came in and Biden stayed above water, had a longer honeymoon of about 6 months. But by the time we got to the late summer of 2021 and the withdrawal, the kind of hapless withdrawal from Afghanistan, Biden also plunged underwater and he has never recovered. And that sets up the possibility, you know, where political science has tended to assume that if you're an incumbent, you have a tremendous advantage in all levels of office, but especially the presidency, simply by inertia, having the tools of communication that a president has, the ability to, you know, sprinkle goodies on different factions of the population in order to get them to come back home to you. But I wonder if we maybe have entered an era now where it's so possible to mobilize opinion against the other side on social media and with other forms of media and communication, that in fact, incumbency is no longer much of a help, that actually it can hurt because you inevitably, after a certain amount of time in office, have like half the country cannot stand you. And so I wonder, you know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if Biden loses, Trump comes in, I guarantee you, even if he does better than he did in either 2016 or 2020, maybe he even, as some polls seem to be implying, that Trump could actually win the popular vote for a change. And even a few polls have him above 50%, which would be a huge shift. But regardless of how he wins, if Trump wins, I guarantee you he'll be underwater, like maybe right out of the gate, if not like a week after he takes the oath of office. And so again, there's just this dynamic, it seems now, where being an incumbent means that you just become a kind of magnet for all the grumbling and unhappiness sort of floating out there. And then winning election becomes a trick of somehow trying to get the electorate to hate the other guy even more.
Yes.
And that's the whole ball game, which is what we're going to be seeing in this election, I think.
Well, you mentioned sprinkling goodies there, which is obviously a great thing an incumbent can have. You know, it's just that's a sort of, I mean, bribery is another way of putting it, isn't it, really? Biden certainly did appear to do it in the midterms in 2022 with student debt forgiveness. That was quite a clever bit of politics he did just before then. He sort of mooted the idea or made it seem like it was about to happen. Certainly the youth vote, there may have been other factors involved there, but certainly that seemed to help him in 2022. And he has been in the Midwestern states in the last few days talking about infrastructure spending and so on. And that could be a way he can claw his way back up the polls. Is it not just the fact that, you know, he can say to people, I'm investing masses of money that's going to help you in your area?
It could. I mean, that is one of those incumbent advantages for a president. I'm sort of unsure about that, partly because of the kind of inflation-riddled environment we're in now. I think, you know, it's not like most Americans were economics majors in college. Most Americans didn't even go to college. But I think most Americans have a kind of intuitive sense of macroeconomics and grasp that inflation gets worse if you spend more money.
Yeah.
And I think it's widely understood that a big contributing factor to the price hikes that we saw here in 2022 and 2023 were largely a function of the Biden administration coming in after there had been these massive spending bills to compensate for COVID slowdown in the economy under Trump. The Democrats came in and 2 months later passed another massive spending bill for almost $2 trillion. And that really did contribute to the inflation surge that we saw up to as high as the high 7% range. And that is Biden's definitely his greatest weakness, not only because of the price hikes, but also because the Fed has raised interest rates to fight the inflation. And it seems to have been largely successful in bringing it down. But that means that people are, if it's not at the grocery store that they're being hit by higher prices, it's that their car loan or their floating mortgage on their house is now way up. Or even if they have a fixed mortgage, if they had been hoping to move sometime in the near future, now it's going to cost them two or three times in a monthly payment what they would have been paying in 2019 when interest rates were very much lower. And so I don't know how much Biden can convince people to come on board just by promising to spend more money, given that his perception as a Democrat is he loves to spend money already. We already know that. And actually, that's making my own personal life worse because it's making me feel poorer all the time. So Biden may be boxed in on this and have limited tools on this front.
Yes. And unless, of course, the economy starts really revving up, as some people think the macro indicators are suggesting it will in the coming months. But we'll have to wait and see on that. You talk there about the sort of negative cycle that American politics has been stuck in for quite some time now. And I thought we had a perfect example of it this weekend with this Trump bloodbath story. Trump gave a speech and he was clearly talking about auto workers, tariffs on cars, which is something he's been talking about since 2016. And the media have taken it out of context, have said that he was threatening a bloodbath if not elected. A ridiculous piece of sort of media hyperbole, which, as everybody who's sane and sensible knows, only helps Trump. And yet it carries on happening. It never stops happening, this process.
No. It was quite remarkable. My own personal story with this is this was on Saturday here in the late afternoon, evening. I actually was busy with family stuff this weekend, so I just kind of quickly checked Twitter in the early evening on Saturday to see if anything was going on. And I see all of these big journalist accounts sharing this clip of Trump, and it says in the, you know, in the way things get shared on Twitter/X, you know, you see the video, but you also have the, you know, what would be a caption in a newspaper, but it's there kind of saying what the video clip is of. And it says, Trump says bloodbath to follow if he loses in 2024. And I almost shared it with some kind of nasty comment about how Trump is so terrible. But I thought, I don't really have time right now to watch the clip and actually hear the context, so I'll pass on it. I didn't do anything. Yeah, you know, then Sunday morning, I get up and I look and I see that now, like, all of social media is in this uproar because if you click through and listen, as you said, the real context is he's saying that it would be a bloodbath with the auto workers and Detroit and car makers and so forth. So it was more of a kind of economic point in typically colorful, sloppy Trump rhetoric. Mm. But the weird thing is that I'm quite sure how this happened is some would-be viral account, who knows who was first, got that clip, grabbed it with a really inflammatory statement, framing it as a statement about like a revolution or civil war in America if he loses. And most people probably did not actually watch the clip before they retweeted it, reshared it, reposted it, whatever vocabulary you use in Elon Musk's world. And within 15 minutes, you had, you know, had accounts all over the world seeing this as if it were true. And this is the way our politics works now. And the Democratic leading journalists and other big accounts have every incentive in the world to kind of believe the worst about Trump. Trump is a master of sort of dancing right up to the line of the most outrageous, incendiary thing you could imagine, and not quite going all the way there and then allowing the media to run with it in a way that makes them look terribly dishonest. And they fall for it every time, as you indicated in the setup. It's, you know, my old right of center colleague, Michael Brendan Doherty, who's at National Review now, he used to be my colleague at The Week, and he wrote a great column. I think it was either very late 2016 or early 2017 in the interregnum between Obama and Trump, in which he predicted that the most momentous thing that we would see from the Trump presidency was Trump driving his enemies insane. That it was not Trump, it was going to be the reaction to Trump that was going to be the most monumental shift in our politics and culture. And I think this has been borne out. You know, I stop at no one in my loathing for this man, partly because he does this to all of us and has this effect on us, which I think is terrible. But I still stand back and kind of shake my head quite frequently at the derangement that he inspires, the sloppiness he provokes. Mm. He sort of has this magic touch of being able to turn his enemies into the most caricatured version of themselves in order to make his own point about how terrible they are.
Yes.
And it's a bad dynamic.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, there was a lot of talk, particularly when Ron DeSantis was sort of seen to be a threat to Trump, about Trump fatigue. And I wondered if you think Trump outrage fatigue is just as powerful a force, in that almost everyone I've spoken to about that Trump story here in Britain, because that's made it over here, almost everyone I speak to here knows the context. You know, even though the newspapers today are still writing it up as a story about Trump saying that there would be a bloodbath, everybody, however many thousands of miles away, knows that that's not the context in which he said it. And it's a sort of shrug. And I feel that perhaps America is also shrugging at Trump, but also shrugging at the reaction to Trump more than ever. That he doesn't engender the sort of hysteria against him that he used to even 4 years ago.
No, that might be true. I mean, a lot of people have written about how even among, you know, like Democrats who will definitely show up to vote for Biden and can't stand Trump and fear him winning again, there is, I think, a palpable sense of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we've been doing this for 8 years and now we have to do this yet again. Mm. And a definite feeling of exhaustion. I mean, I felt it covering Trump for 4 years as a journalist. When Biden won and we got through the really crazy period between the two administrations where January 6th happened and all of that, once we got into the Biden administration, it was like we could exhale for a moment, like, okay, like a normal president and normal kind of coverage of that president. We kind of all took a breather, you know, ratings and traffic at TV and cable news and then online news sites, you know, really tanked, you know, like no one was watching the news. People disengaged, felt like, I can skip the news for a little while because I don't have to worry that the country is going to, you know, fly apart in a million pieces into anarchy, like I worried for the last 4 years. But now we're headed back into this again. And I think a lot of people almost can't believe it. I know a lot of Democrats who no matter how often I point to the polls that clearly show that Biden is behind, not by a lot, but, you know, the fact that Trump's floor seems to be much higher than it was in 2016 or 2020. He's polling better from every polling outfit at the national and swing state level. He's polling better than he ever has in the past. And there are a lot of Democrats who simply refuse to believe that this could be true. Very quickly moving to the what's called among data journalists, like the unskewing narrative, that like the polls are wrong. The data is wrong. We have to unskew them, meaning like add in weights to explain why they're wrong because we know they have to be wrong. This first seemed to happen in 2012 when a lot of Romney supporters refused to believe he was losing to Obama.
Yeah.
And now it's Democrats who are already going in for this, even though it is only March and things could turn around. I mean, maybe by next September, October, things have flipped and it's Biden up a few points over Trump in most polls. And if that's true, I assume it'll be very, very close and Biden might even win. But at the moment, Biden is losing. And a lot of Democrats don't want to believe it. And I do think the fatigue factor is motivating a lot of that. They simply cannot conceive of having to endure another 4 years.
Yeah, well, Damon, lastly, one of the unskewering weights that you mentioned there could be low propensity voters, because it seems that Trump is doing very well among low propensity voting groups. He always has done among whites, but it seems like now he's doing well amongst low propensity voting groups in other ethnicities and other demographics. And so perhaps there is a polling error in his favor, because Biden voters tend to be quite high propensity voters. Is that a correct reading of the situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that pollsters are always dealing with samples and they have to make educated guesses about the right mix of the different groups that they capture in their sample. And we saw in 2016 and 2020 that the polls somewhat understated Trump's support. In both cycles, Trump was at like around 42-43% support going into the election, and he ended up around 46-47%. And so it's possible that pollsters this time around are trying to overcompensate by that by turning the knobs behind the scenes and overweighting people who are saying they support for Trump, making it seem like they are a bigger portion of the electorate than they really are, and also assuming that they will show up to the voting booth in November versus people who say they support Trump, but yet won't be bothered that morning. You know, maybe it'll rain and they'll say, I don't want to get wet, so I'll stay home today. Turnout, that's what I'm talking about, is, you know, who's going to actually turn out to vote on that key day. And, you know, the assumption about which voters will turn out and which will not is a guess. It's always a guess. And the question is, you know, in the 2022 midterm elections, the Democrats overperformed. There was no Republican wave like we have seen in the past in 1994 and in 2010. It didn't materialize under Biden, and a lot of that could have been because of the Dobbs decision about abortion, overturning Roe v. Wade, really had women on the left very animated. And so they showed up well in excess of what they normally would in a midterm election, where turnout tends to be low. But then the question is, in a presidential election, that is not an off-cycle election. That's the one more people that show up to vote for than anything else. And so one would assume both sides would be maximally motivated. And then the question is, which side has a better kind of ground operation to make sure that those voters you mentioned, the low propensity voters who sort of don't pay full attention, they swing back and forth in a way that political analysts like myself find completely inexplicable. Like, what? You voted for Obama, Trump, Biden, and now you're going to vote for Trump again? Like, what? Who does that? But there are millions of Americans who do things like that. And the key is, they say they're going to vote for Trump again, but do they want to enough that they'll actually get out of the house that morning and do the work of waiting in a line and pulling the lever for him? And we don't know for sure. And again, pollsters are making educated guesses about how many of them will. And so it's possible. Maybe the lesson of this whole cycle will be when Biden wins comfortably a reelection, like one would normally expect an incumbent to do, then we'll go back and say, well, we used to say Trump was at 43 and he got 47. Now we said Trump has 48 and in fact he had 45. That would still be pretty close, but it would be the decisive difference.
And I suppose setting against that, you've got to the enthusiasm gap in the polls. Certainly that's in Trump's favor at the moment. And that would suggest higher turnout for Trump.
Yeah, it would. It's that exhaustion problem on among the Democrats that, you know, how many Democrats are really going to be able to muster the enthusiasm to show up to vote for Biden when, you know, we haven't really had a chance to talk about Biden's own coalitional difficulties, but the progressive left, say the 10% most left-leaning Democrats are very, very angry with him over his support for Israel and its war on Hamas and Gaza. And, you know, in certain key swing states like Michigan, which has a relatively large Muslim population, and it's a very close swing state, that could be the difference in whether he wins Michigan. And if he loses Michigan, he has to pick up some other swing states where he's down even more right now, like Nevada, Arizona, Georgia. So the question is, can Biden get kind of the non-progressive left voters to get very, very motivated and enthusiastic to show up to compensate for the fact that on the far left of the party, there are going to be a lot of people saying, you know what, I can't stand Trump, but I hate Biden so much. I want him to go down as a lesson to the Democratic Party that people like me should have more say in the future. I think that would be deadly for the party in general elections if it shifted to the left. But, you know, that's a long old fight that is nowhere near coming to an end. We'll be fighting about that as Democrats, I think, till the end of time.
Till end times. It does feel a bit end times at the moment. But thank you very much, Damon, for coming on to Americano again. It's a great pleasure to have you back.
Always happy to be here. Take care.
That's it for that episode of the Americano podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I'd like to thank our brilliant Spectator production team, Natasha Feroz, my producer, Oscar Edmondson, who's sitting opposite me. And I would like to ask any listeners who have ideas as to who they think I should get on the podcast. We're going to be doing two a week, so we have to come up with plenty of ideas this year. And often you have much better ideas than I do. So please do get in touch if you have an idea of a guest that you think we should try and get on the show, or a subject that you think we haven't covered that we should be covering. And please email that to podcast@spectator.co.uk, or you can get in touch with me directly on Twitter. I think my handle is FreddieGray31, which is depressingly how old I was when I set up my Twitter account. Okay, please do that. Goodbye.